Exodus chapter 12 and chapter 13. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, "This month shall be your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, 'On the tenth of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb, according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of the persons. According to each man's need, you shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight. And they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat it. Then they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs. They shall eat it. Do not eat it raw, nor boiled at all with water, but roasted in fire, its head with its legs and its entrails. You shall let none of it remain until morning, and what remains of it until morning you shall burn with fire, and thus you shall eat it. With a belt on your waist, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand, you shall eat of it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night, and will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. Now the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be on you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. So this day shall be to you a memorial, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses. For whoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. On the first day there shall be a holy convocation, and on the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation for you. No manner of work shall be done on them, but that which everyone must eat, that only may be prepared by you. So you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread. For on this same day I will have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting ordinance. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. For 7 days no leaven shall be found in your houses. Since whoever eats what is leavened, that same person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is a stranger or a native of the land. You shall eat nothing leavened. In all your dwellings you shall eat unleavened bread. Then Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said to them, "Pick out and take lambs for yourselves according to your families, and kill the Passover lamb. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood that is in the basin, and strike the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood that is in the basin. And none of you shall go out of the door of his house until morning. For the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to strike you. And you shall observe this thing as an ordinance for you and your sons forever. It will come to pass when you come to the land which the Lord will give you, just as he promised, that you shall keep this service. And it shall be when your children say to you, what do you mean by this service? That you shall say, it is the Passover sacrifice of the Lord, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he struck the Egyptians and delivered our households. So the people bowed their heads and worshipped. Then the children of Israel went away and did so just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron. So they did. And it came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive, who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. So Pharaoh rose in the night, he, all his servants, and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt. For there was not a house where there was not one dead. Then he called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, rise, go out from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go, serve the Lord as you have said. Also take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone, and bless me also. And the Egyptians urged the people that they might send them out of the land in haste, for they said, we shall all be dead. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, having their kneading bowls bound up in their clothes on their shoulders. Now the children of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, and they had asked from the Egyptians articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they granted them what they requested. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. Then the children of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides children. A mixed multitude went up with them also, and flocks and herds, a great deal of livestock. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they had brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were driven out of Egypt and could not wait, nor had they prepared provisions for themselves. Now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. It came to pass at the end of the 430 years, on that very same day, it came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It is a night of solemn observance to the Lord for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is that night of the Lord, a solemn observance for all the children of Israel throughout their generations. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover. No foreigner shall eat it. But every man's servant who is bought for money, when you have circumcised him, then he may eat it. A sojourner and a hired servant shall not eat it. In one house it shall be eaten. You shall not carry any of the flesh outside the house, nor shall you break one of its bones. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. And when a stranger dwells with you and wants to keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it. And he shall be as a native of the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat it. One law shall be for the native born and for the stranger who dwells among you. Thus all the children of Israel did, as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. And it came to pass on that very same day that the Lord brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, according to their armies. Chapter 13, Exodus. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, consecrate to me all the firstborn. Whatever opens the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and beast, it is mine. And Moses said to the people, Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. On this day you are going out in the month Abib. And it shall be, when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, This is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. It shall be as a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year. And it shall be, when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your fathers, and gives it to you, that you shall set apart to the Lord all that opened the womb, that is, every firstborn that comes from an animal which you have, the males shall be the Lord's. But every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb, and if you shall not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. And all the firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. So it shall be, when your son asks you in time to come, saying, What is this? That you shall say to him, By strength of hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And it came to pass, when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, that the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore I sacrifice to the Lord all males that open the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. It shall be as a sign on your hand and as frontlets between your eyes. For by strength of hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt. Then it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near, for God said, Lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for they had placed the children of Israel under solemn oath, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here with you. So they took their journey from Succoth, and camped in Etham at the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people.
Well, we've gone through this reading here of the couple of chapters, Exodus 12 and 13. So I guess what would be good to is to go over, a brief recap of some of the major elements we have here, you know, just so that we're all on the same page here, so to speak, and to refresh our memories and to move forward from here. So I guess the first thing you see here is the talk about Aviv. This is that it kind of anchors us in time with what we're talking about. Month of Aviv is talk about the first of months, and as we get with that, the word Aviv, one way I guess to translate it, it's been translated many different ways, but one way is to like the greening of the ears, kind of the idea that this is a springtime kind of thing. So you're anchoring this in the springtime. So we get the first anchor there.
And what are the other anchors that we have here?
We've got what it's called, and you'll see this, kind of referred to this as it, the Pesach, or as it is in Hebrew, or the Passover. It's often just called the Passover. Now, what is the Passover? You know, it's described as either a lamb or a kid. So we've got those, that anchor in there. So when we're thinking about what are the main symbols of Passover, we've got that. And then, of course, what is the other one that they talk about a lot? Unleavened bread. Oh, hello. And also bitter herbs. And with the Passover, we also have blood. And of course, with that goes the hyssop. Anything else, sir, that we have as major symbols or icons in this? You might think of some things in this that's also the destroyer. Destroyer factors in big in the Exodus. And also that kind of factors in this is not necessarily a tangible symbol, but haste. Haste is a big part of this as well. But it's, you know, people like to say haste makes waste. Why is that kind of a common phrase? What is the thought with that?
Generally, when you're hasty, you don't make wise decisions. Sometimes you throw away things that you don't think you need, and you realize, oops, gee, I could have used that if I didn't throw it away. That's kind of a haste makes waste kind of thing. One example.
Yeah.
Basically, just in your hastiness, you're going to end up doing something that's going to hurt you or harm you in the long run, which
end up
would be wasteful.
Forgetting something, overlooking something, cutting corners to try to get it done,
right.
That kind of thing. Now, what's different about the haste here with this Passover?
Quickly.
It's also...
You can't sit around and contemplate it. You've got to make your decision right then and there, whether you're going or you're staying.
And it's also not your decision to do something. You're following the instructions that God has made. So if there's... As long as you're following his instructions, you're not going to have to worry about you forgetting something. Mm-hmm. You're being obedient.
Yeah, and also in the sense that when it comes, you got to be ready to go. Because this destroyer is going to come at midnight. And that's going to be the trigger. But in the meantime, you're supposed to be going through and having this meal here. But you're supposed to be kind of like waiting for the trigger. You know when he's coming. You know what he's going to do. And you know what's going to follow after that. But you just have to sit there and be ready and wait until it comes.
One thing that's was mentioned also that no one was to go outside that door during this time.
Ah.
He did not want anybody wandering around.
Interesting, yes.
Outside of the house,
so,
he wanted everybody to stay put and do what they were told.
So,
it was a serious thing.
Yeah, so you picked up another one of the icons here, the doorposts. So that's also a very important thing. And you'll see, as you look down through this list of items here, that there's interplane and between all the various symbols, and they're all weaving together. When you think of each of these things separately, it seems kind of like an incongruous picture. A lot of clashing ideas, you know, bitter herbs with blood, you know, bread with blood, and doorposts and stuff like that. It can get to be a bit of an incongruous picture. But you might say that the destroyer was coming at midnight, but why was the destroyer coming? This is the pivotal part of this whole Passover Exodus thing here, is the destroyer, along with the lamb, the tenth plague. But it's also one of the main problems that people have with God on this. People have a big problem with the destroyer in this story and this account here. But what was the destroyer's job?
The destroyer is actually the angel of the Lord. It's not the devil, which we normally think destroyer.
We got a destroyer that's coming through. That's one idea. Yes.
But you've got first in verse 12, and I, God speaking, will pass through in the land of Egypt in this night, and I will smite every firstborn in the land of Egypt. And then it's only later in the verse, a few verses down, then it becomes the Meshit.
That's right. So you see this also, again, when we read later about the angel of the Lord, they'll say the angel of the Lord does this, and they'll say, like, the Lord does this, or I do this. So you have this this great congruence between these ideas of God taking action and these representations of Him. In this case, He's coming as the destroyer. Now, again, why is He coming as the destroyer? Look at Exodus 12, verse 12. Exodus 12, verse 12. Why is He coming as a destroyer?
To judge.
To judge. Judge what?
Against all the gods of Egypt.
But why? I mean, you know, like what a lot of people say today, you know, they can have their God, we can have our God. Just keep in your border, I'll keep in my border, and everything will be fine.
Because the Egyptians wouldn't let them go to worship Him.
Ah, so we got the enslavement kind of thing. Now, that's a great point, what Pat brought up. They said that the Egyptians, specifically Pharaoh, would not let them go and keep this appointment. You know, as we read earlier in Exodus, you got this idea that they were supposed to keep an appointment with God, and Pharaoh would not let them do it. Now, why wouldn't he let them do it?
God hardened his heart.
He hardened his heart, but more than that.
Stubbornness.
Pride. More than that.
He didn't like the economic impact it was going to make on them.
Ah, more than that.
Why? They were his slaves.
Okay, but more than that, what was it that the destroyer was coming to do? Bring judgment upon the gods. What was it Pharaoh said?
He's a god.
He said he's a god, and you know the Lord said to Moses that you were going to be a god, or you know, an Elohim to Pharaoh. So what did Pharaoh say to Moses when he came in with this request to go out in the desert 3 days?
He granted it at first.
I don't know you. Who is this Lord guy? Who is this Lord that I should bow to Him? You know, so what you're talking about here is you got God's people in Egypt, and you have here at play who is really God. You know,
who's the more powerful God?
Well, you might even think of who is God at all.
And
in a sense in that regard. Because you know, if you think about the difference between a light bulb and the power plant, if you unplug the light from the wall, there ain't no light anymore. The light goes out because it's disconnected from the power. So you might say that the various Elohim that we hear about, these principalities of the air out there, they all get their power from one source, and they're all granted their power from one source. And that was it. What we have the question here, when you go through all the plagues, and these plagues were brought down as judgments upon the various gods of Egypt here. But in a sense, this was like an Elijah moment here on Mount Carmel. The idea of who is really God? Who is really God? So you have the idea also of haste. And with haste here, you've got the idea of one of the reasons that's connected here specifically between haste is that you're going out, and one of the symbols of haste is unleavened bread. And that was kind of like the eternal symbol. You know, for 7 days you're going to eat unleavened bread. And why was it to be unleavened, as we read about in this passage?
Didn't have time to let it rise.
And also, they're going to be chugging along. As you said, they went day and night, day and night, day and night, until they got to the sea. Until they got to the sea, then they stopped. So in this passage here that we read today, there was also a lot of talk about teaching various things to children. And one of the things that we are going to be going through a lot tonight during the Seder, the Passover Seder, is a lot about teaching the children. And one of the things that gets in there are the four questions that are asked. You know, why is this night different from other nights, etc.? But you see here in this passage that there are some specific questions, actually, that children ask. Look at Exodus 12:27. We pick up one of those questions there. Exodus 12:27. You see it there first in 26 is the question. What is the question there in verse 26?
What do you mean by this service?
Yeah, I mean, why are we doing this? You know, comes down today is, why is this night different from all other nights? But basically the question is, okay, so what is all this about? About, you know, bread and lamb and stuff like that. Why should we care here generations later about this? And what do we have as the answer there in verse 27? Exodus 12:27.
It is the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians and delivered our houses.
Yeah, okay. So deliverance. We get this idea of passing over and deliverance. So that's one of the first answers to the next generation as to why this all matters. Deliverance and passing over. And as we've looked in the past at the whole word there, the root word for Pesach, for Passover, it's an idea of kind of an active blocking, causing to limp or something like that. So you have this kind of active action that God is taking in bypassing the homes where there was blood on the doorpost, the blood of the Passover lamb. Okay, so we drop down to one of the other questions there. Look at in chapter 13 at verse, let's see, getting down there in verse 3. Kind of gives us an idea as to what else we're supposed to get out of this. So what does it say there in verse 3? Remember this day in which you went out from Egypt, from the house of slavery. By a powerful hand the Lord brought you out from this place, and nothing unleavened shall be eaten. Okay. So what are we supposed to get out of this? This is one of the other reasons why we remember this.
God's deliverance to the people, his strong hand.
Strong hand. We're talking about with a powerful hand, a strong hand, that he's leading out. Why is that important? Because we're thinking about it, you know, remember deliverance, we remember the blocking of God's judgment that was to come on the rest of Egypt. Okay, and here we got remembering with a powerful hand.
Well, again, the nine plagues prior to the destroyer, those were all miraculous things that just not anybody could, you know, conjure up out of nothing. That was huge, and yet the children of Israel were not harmed by those plagues. And then later down the road, how he, maybe out of sequence, but by his strong hand, he also delivered them from the armies chasing after him, Pharaoh himself chasing after them through the Red Sea, delivering them from that.
Yeah, so we've got 10 examples of God's strong hand actually bringing Egypt one of the mighty nations of the world to its knees, bring it to its knees with these things that came along. And plus, then you also have going through the Red Sea, which was also quite amazing, to say the very least.
Now, down in verse 8, we get another one of these questions that pops up. Exodus 13, verse 8.
You shall tell it to your son that day, saying, it is because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt. And you shall serve, and it shall serve as a sign to you on your hand, and as a reminder on your forehead, that the law of the Lord may be in your mouth. For with a powerful hand the Lord brought you out of Egypt. Therefore you shall keep this ordinance at its appointed time from year to year. Okay, we've already talked about the powerful hand and why that's important to remember. So what else do we get out of this? Yes.
Well, the rabbis interpret that as everybody who participates in a Passover remembrance year by year, it is as if they personally were brought out of Egypt.
And, aha!
Yeah.
So you see that there? What he did for me.
The tense, it is what he did to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, even as you're passing it on to your children and your children's children, well, those children might not have been born yet, but future generations are to say, it is what he did for me. So it becomes a personal testimony. And you are to participate in the Seder as if it's happened to you. And it, so that it is continually throughout every generation, for every generation.
If you remember in a present tense, not a past tense.
All right.
Because, you know, his power wasn't just back then, but it is presently, you know, here now, in that this is the same God, you know, beginning and the end. Yeah.
Because we're talking about, you know, in our time now, it's 3,200 to 3,500 years later. And to be looking at this, that we went through this. But notice something also that you see in there. It almost seems like just like what we saw in the previous one. It's like, okay, remember with a powerful hand and eat unleavened bread. Like, okay. It's like someone's talking to you and suddenly they take a right turn. Now, what is it in this one here that we see that just kind of like, it seems like it just got dropped in out of the air, out of this passage. Exodus 13, you know, they're starting in 8, verse 8.
But isn't that a picture of the leaven of the Pharisees for us now?
Well, we'll get to that. I mean, that's an important picture of what we're looking at. But in this passage here, it says, you know, and it will serve as a sign on your hand. Okay, where does that come from?
Between your eyes,
yep.
Which would be forehead.
Yep.
And Revelation talks about
the sign on your forehead or on your hand.
And also Susan was saying that when the 144 are to be marked.
Yep. God's gonna go around and mark.
A seal.
A signature of God. Ownership. Remember, we were talking about a lot of the story of Passover is basically a deed transfer. The people of God are going from the deed ownership of Pharaoh to the deed ownership of God. So a lot of that's talked about there. But when we think about this particular idea, it's connected with something that that the Jews have been saying for a long time, a prayer that usually starts every day. It comes from Deuteronomy chapter 6. You know, hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Okay, well, let me ask you a question. How many of these things would end up being written on your hand and on your forehead and on your doorpost? No, I'm just talking about practically. We just saw it back here in Exodus. It says, write this and put this on your hand, put it on your forehead. And then in Deuteronomy it says, put this. You know, this is Deuteronomy, if you recall, is basically the reaffirmation of God's deal with Israel, the next generation after the Exodus. So he's doing this all over again. So when you're looking at this practically, you've got the practical symbols of something that ends up being on your hand and on your forehead and on your doorposts.
It's blood that shows ownership. It's the redemption. The blood redeemed us, and it shows the signs are to show ownership.
The signs show ownership, and that's part of what gets included on what you're writing on your hand and on your forehead. And just like we've seen throughout the Bible, in the sign of the hand and the forehead and the doorposts, these are like the tangible parts of your body. You see that again with the various things that go on the priest, go on his feet, go on his head. These are various things like when your head, of course, the right between your eyes. You know, I think that might be an idea of modern anatomy, that this is where, like, your higher reasoning morality center is thought of. But that was thought from very ancient times, that is where you get that kind of discernment. Now, also on your hands, obviously, is you got that idea that your hands are what you do, what you are doing in your life. And you also talk about with your feet being where you go, the doorposts being, you know, today the door frame of your front door is the entry to your house. So what is there at the front is kind of the exterior of your house. What comes in and what goes out has to go by that, whether it comes in or where it goes out. And when we go into our own homes, do we remember what it is, what our house is really all about? And when we go out into the daily life, do we remember what our house is really built upon? So you get this idea of something tangible that's there, but this is something more, because if you were to, you know, put the five books of Moses and all of the things, or at least Exodus and Deuteronomy, on your hand and on your forehead, you'd have quite a weight going on unless you put it in microfiche. So this is something physical and something spiritual and moral going on beyond that. So that's part of what you end up having to teach the next generation, is that these are not just things that we do. You know, we don't just have the Passover Seder, blah, 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 let's hurry up and get it done and go on with the next thing. These are things that we are showing and doing and internalizing, just like what we saw with the Shema. You know, these are things that are supposed to be upon our hearts. The idea of God writing His law in our hearts is hardly new. It goes all the way back here to this time. But when we look at, if you turn for a moment just over to Deuteronomy 6, if you're not already there, Deuteronomy 6, where the Shema is, or I should say probably one of the best remembered of the Shemas. As we've studied through Deuteronomy, we've seen that there are quite a few Shemas, which means basically hear and obey. When we think of this hear and obey, we get this one here of hear and obey, O Israel, that the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And that shows up, you know, when Yeshua was asked, what's the greatest commandment? It came back as this one. And I guess the question is, just to refresh ourselves, why is this the greatest command? Why is that?
Why is what?
Why is, hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Why is that the greatest commandment?
Because you have to build on that.
Why?
Well, there's no other solid foundation to build on.
Why not?
Because he said so.
Okay, but there's got to be some sort of reason as to why there are two things that Yeshua said are the greatest commandments. This one, and love your neighbor as yourself, which comes from Leviticus chapter 19. So why those two things?
Because in doing this, you're doing the others as well.
Okay, how so?
Because by loving God and following him, you obey all the other ones.
Yeah, you put him first. You put him first. He is one. In the battle between Pharaoh and the gods of Egypt and the Lord, there was a battle between who is God. You know, who is the Lord that I'm going to serve him? That was Pharaoh's great thing kicked back to Moses as to why should I listen to him? You know, let him hang out in, up there in Canaan. You know, I've got my gods down here in Egypt.
Well, the first of the Ten Commandments is, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt.
Aha.
You shall have no other gods before me.
That's right.
The way we list the commandments is not the correct way. Yahweh actually is the first commandment. Is, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. We very often don't include that. But that should be the first. Because then he says, you shall have no other gods before me. That's critical.
And that's why we have no other gods.
Right, because he was the one that demonstrated the greatest power.
He broke the power of all the other principalities that were there in Egypt. He came through and he broke them. And it wasn't that Pharaoh ended up letting him go. They pushed Israel out.
Question.
Yeah.
In the New Testament, it says, a new commandment I give you.
Mm-hmm.
But you just said that both of those are in the Old Testament. Yeah. So why does it say new?
Ah. Now, in the context of that, we're talking about the Sermon of the Mount, what's commonly called there. Okay. Now, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to get to that in just a little bit about what the whole point of that is. So if you just bear with me for a moment, we're going to get to that one. Because, I mean, that's a very good question, and it gets to a lot of why we're doing and remembering these things here in the future. So please don't let me forget that one, because that is actually a part of where we're going with this. But when we look through the rest of chapter 6 in Deuteronomy, you see in here that we do not forget that God is the one who delivers us from the land. There in verses 10 through 13, he's talking about that the things, the land where God is going to take us is not something that we earned. We're going to a place that somebody else owned. The ownership has changed and we've been delivered to it. So we're going to some place that we have not earned and God is taking us to it. And of course you got in verse 14, don't follow other gods where you're going. And this is a really important one in chapter 6. Look down in verse, starting in verse 20. Here we got another question. And this relates to Passover. In Deuteronomy 6, starting in verse 20. When your son asks you in time to come, saying, what do the testimonies and the statutes and judgments mean which the Lord our God commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we are slaves to Pharaoh. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us from Egypt with a mighty hand. Moreover, the Lord showed great and distressing signs and wonders before our eyes against Egypt, Pharaoh and all his household. He brought us out from there in order to bring us in, to give us the land which he had sworn to our fathers. So the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our own good always and for our survival as it is today. It will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe all this commandment before the Lord your God, just as he commanded us. Okay, so we've got a couple kind of big points in there to think about with this passage. Got some of the things of the mighty hand, all these wonders before Pharaoh. Now, what does it say there in verse 24? About the why. An answer to the why question.
He ordered us to keep them for our own good.
For our own good and survival.
That he might preserve us alive.
Yeah, preserve us alive to this day. Okay, we definitely see the outgrowth of that throughout Israel's history. Okay, now what about 25?
Then it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe all these commandments before the Lord our God, as he has commanded us. Righteousness.
Okay, so we got the question. It's heading towards Kathy's question that she brought up earlier about this new command. Now, I guess the question comes in this is, when you're saying that observing all this commandment makes us righteous? What about parts of the word that say, you know, all our righteous deeds are like a filthy garment or literally a menstrual garment? What about all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God? How does that work? How does observing all this command before the Lord involve righteousness? That's a good question. Oh, here we go.
He made us righteous.
Ah, good. All right. We got one right off the bat.
Well, but then in Romans 10 it says, for they being ignorant of God's righteousness and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God, for Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone that believeth.
Okay, so great. We got that one on there as well. So let's address that one there specifically. So I guess when you look at this, these are important questions that we have to look at. But amid these, just as she had mentioned, we've got these passages where God says he is the one who makes us holy. You know, there's several passages there in Exodus and Leviticus. They're specifically like Exodus 31:13. You know, if you observe my Sabbath, because, you know, I am the one who makes you holy. And a lot of what he talks about in Leviticus 20, 21, 22, about the priesthood and how he's setting up the priests. He says, do this because I am the one who makes you holy. Okay, so we got that one down about on this question about, well, what do you mean by the righteousness connected with observing the commandment? Because when you think about it, you know, righteous, what is the difference between the word righteous and the word holy? What is the difference?
Righteousness is right standing with God, and holy is being apart.
Yeah, so you got righteousness is simply right and wrong, and you go the correction that is right. So you've got morality there. There's got to be a right side and there's got to be a wrong side, the way things work and the way they don't work. So with righteous, you're going in a right direction, and righteousness is continuing on in a right direction. Holy, we've got the idea of setting it apart, consecrated, put apart for a specific purpose on that.
Separate,
okay. So the idea of God making us holy is a part of the adoption process. You know, we've been talking a lot about when we went through Matthew about this ministry or this message of reconciliation and humility. This was one of the great messages that Yeshua brought, was the idea of that we are humble before God, and that God is bringing us in and ending, I guess you would call it, the war against him and us, between basically the rebels, bringing the rebels into the family, and ending our rebelliousness, and eventually, as we read the end of Revelation, ending the rebellion altogether. So, on that sense of bringing in the adoption, there's a great passage in Hebrews chapter 2 that also touches on this, what we're talking about here. Hebrews chapter 2, starting in verse 10. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 10. It talks about this idea of God making us holy and also about moving from slavery. You know, a lot of talk about slavery in Egypt into a different kind of ownership under God. In bringing many sons to glory, it was fitting that God, for whom and through whom everything exists, should make the author of their salvation perfect through suffering. Okay, we know who that's talking about, obviously, Yeshua. Both the one who makes men holy and those who are made holy are of the same family. So Yeshua is not ashamed to call them brothers. He says, "I will declare your name to my brothers. In the presence of the congregation, I will sing your praises. And again, I will put my trust in him." And again he says, "Here am I and the children God has given me." Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in the humanity so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is, the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. For surely it is not angels he helps, but Abraham's descendants. For this reason, he had to be made like his brothers in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people. Because he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Okay, so we got this. What does this tell us about how this idea of God making us holy and why he's making us holy?
He can have no communion with us unless that happens first.
Yeah, okay. You know, the idea of holiness or being completely set apart and being in a divine realm.
He's not going to fellowship with me if I have fellowship with other gods or other, you know, authorities that are in opposition to him. It's, you know, it's why he brought them out of Egypt. It's why he made with them at Mount Sinai. It's about setting them apart and consecrating them or sanctifying them unto himself and himself alone.
Okay, so we got the idea of having it pure and not mixed.
I just read from Romans 10, and that word in that translation says Christ is the end of the law or the end of the Torah, but really that word is badly translated. It's telos. It means goal. Messiah is the goal. I should really read Messiah is the goal at which the Torah is aiming at. That's the whole sense of that. So in the Messiah, we are then enabled to do Deuteronomy 6, 23, because in Messiah, we are completely doing all the righteous requirements of the Torah.
Mm-hmm. Here are we?
He is the one. Well, we can now, it's really hard, as the New Testament points out, to keep all of the 613. But in Messiah, you are brought to the goal at which the Torah is aiming, which is righteousness.
Which is
not based on works, but our works, but on what Yeshua, the Lamb of God, has already done, taken away the sins of the world.
Right, which will be something that will become clear in just a moment. Because the passage that I was talking about earlier, you know, that all have sinned and fallen short, is from Paul's letter to the Romans, of course, there in Romans 3:23. But it's helpful to kind of get the idea of the context that you're talking about here. Paul's letter to the Romans was about what?
Sin.
If you were to just sum it up in one sentence.
Salvation.
Salvation. For whom?
Jews and Gentiles.
Bingo. Okay. If you got that idea of the context of Romans and pretty much all of Paul's letters, you're right on target for helping to kind of figure things out here. So that is the context of Romans. Now, what is the context of Romans chapter 3 specifically?
Actually, look at 3:25.
Okay. Well, first start with verse 1. That's always a good place to start. What is the context of Romans chapter 3?
What advantage then has the Jew, or what is the profit of circumcision?
All right. So there we go. We got the specific one. What is the profit of circumcision? What's the benefit of Jew over Gentile? Okay, so that is the context of this. Now, if we were to kind of look at the whole realm of this passage here from Romans, start with verse 19, Romans 3:19. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God. Because by the works of the law, no flesh shall be justified in his sight. For through the law comes the knowledge of sin. But now apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets, even the righteousness of God through faith in Yeshua Messiah for all those who believe. For there is no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, being justified as a gift by his grace through the redemption which is in Messiah Yeshua, whom God displayed publicly as a propitiation in his blood through faith. This was to demonstrate his righteousness, because in the forbearance of God he passed over the sins previously committed. For the demonstration, I say, of his righteousness at the present time, so that he would be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Yeshua. Where then is boasting? It is excluded. By what kind of law? Of works? No. But by a law of faith. For we maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from the works of the law. Or is God the God of Jews only? Is he not the God of Gentiles also? Yes, of Gentiles also. Since indeed God, who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through faith, is one. Do we then nullify the law through faith? May it never be. On the contrary, we establish the law. So when you're looking at this idea of, you know, all have sinned and fallen short, I mean, that is obviously true. Sue was referring to, you know, the ideas of sin, transgression, and iniquity are varying degrees of being off course. You know, sin or chet is basically the idea of pulling back the bow and shooting at a target and missing. So the idea that you want to hit the target, but you're missed. Then transgression then is what?
Disobeying.
Okay, kind of a more of a willful act to it.
Knowledgeable.
Yeah.
Missing.
Okay, and iniquity. Outright rebellion. Okay, so you got these varying degrees of where you're going with this. Now, you come down to the idea of this idea of being justified. Now, is there a difference between being justified, or if you were to look at this as like a court case, being declared not guilty before God, and righteousness? What is the difference between, I'm going to say, justified and righteous?
Righteousness is the character of God, walking in his character.
Okay, that's justice. So, one who is justified is what?
Somebody who's been
one who's not under the law.
You know, if you say that he was justified to have done this, what does that mean?
Self-defense. I was attacked, I hit someone, someone takes a battery charges against me, the judge determined, no, it was a justified response to being attacked.
It means that there was a judgment.
Right.
Yes, a declaration.
Yes, it was a declaration of justice. So that obviously you've got just, kind of comes in the root form of that. So you've got justice. You've got a declaration of a judgment, you know, and judgments go guilty, not guilty, and obviously we've got all kinds of variations of that. But basically, I guess you can kind of think of this as guilty, not guilty. So, in the eyes of God, what justifies us?
Blood of the Lamb.
Okay, the blood of the Lamb. Because you think about the first Passover, what justified Israel during the 10th plague?
Obedience.
The blood of the Lamb. You know.
Doorposts.
Yeah. Because if they were to go outside the doorposts, they were toast. God, as destroyer, would have gotten them. So they were justified there. Now, what about righteous?
That's standing.
Okay. Like we were talking about earlier, you know, you've got this right. Right and wrong. So if righteous, you are going in the right direction.
Isn't that imputed righteousness? It's something God gave us.
God shows us also. Yeah. But you think about this as like, if you're to like think of this as your rap sheet. Hopefully none of you have a rap sheet. But if you do, justified blanks it. It's gone. There is nothing on your rap sheet. Righteous keeps it blank.
Right.
So being righteous will not get rid of your rap sheet. You know. Try pulling your righteousness with a cop when he pulls you over after speeding. And see how much that works. And it's kind of a very tangible example of what you're talking about here. But justified, you know, once that your criminal record is gone, by keeping on that path, you're going in that right path. But if you come from an area or a background that was completely unrighteous, it's a huge change. It's a huge change. And it's a huge change that God has to make. You know, if any of you are having to suffer with something that is just plaguing you and temptations that plague you day after day, no matter what they are, you know, you've got to have God show you the right path every single moment of the day. Otherwise, you're going to go off the rails, so to speak. So, kind of have a good example of those two. Now, kind of also working back toward Kathy's question there about this, comes from the a phrase that we have here in Romans chapter 3. Various translations have this. The New American Standard has works of the law. The New Revised... this would be... is found in verse 20 and also down in verse 28. This idea, works prescribed by the law, is what the Revised Standard Version has. The NIV has observing the law. So these all come from the Greek phrase. There you go. Here's your Greek of the day. Ergon nomu. Ergon nomu. Works law. Or, yeah, you know, I guess it'd be works of. Works of law. That's what you had there specifically. And if you want to look it up in your lexicons, this is in Greek, 2041, under the Strong's numbers, and the other one is 3551. So, ergo nomu. And this is found also in Galatians, where he hits on this also as well. Works of law. And the thing of circumcision comes up a lot in Galatians. Yeah, I guess some people think that Galatians is like the rough draft for the book of Romans, because, you know, Romans is a very crystallized, logical thought from beginning to end, and Romans is kind of dropping in on a, I guess, putting a fire out, I guess you could say.
Galatians.
Yeah, Galatians, thank you.
And Galatians is putting a fire out on the particular issues that were going on there. Now,
which one's more logical?
Oh, Romans. Romans, you know, Romans is very challenging to drop in out of from outer space, because if you do so, you can get kind of on a wrong track, because people will pick and choose out of Romans and come up with all kinds of strange ideas if you don't follow things through to the end of the argument or the point that Paul is trying to make. And you can see that here, especially in Romans chapter 3. Because you can go through Romans chapter 3 and say, oh, well, God hates the law. He wants it done away with. Well, what do you end up with at the end of the chapter? No. He establishes the law.
Right.
His point is this, that justified is different from righteous. Justified is something that God does. Righteous is something that he wants to push us toward and shows us how to do it. So, yeah.
He also says that if you love me, I will keep my commandments.
Ah.
It's a relationship thing. When you love somebody and this person, let's just remove God from the situation, but just in general, when you love somebody and you have a relationship with someone and they desire you to do something or not to do something and you truly love them, you're going to follow those commands or those things that they have shared with you from their heart, because out of love you want to please them and serve them. You're keeping their commands in essence. Back to God, he says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. He has given us commandments to keep. That shows that we truly love him and are following him. In the keeping of them, this is where faith happens. It's in the doing. We may not understand it fully at the time, but there's wisdom in that. We hear it, we act upon it, and when we act upon it, we understand later why these are put in place, because of the relationship with God, your love for him, and the commandments he's given to us out of love for us to keep us from sin, keep us out of trouble, keep us healthy even. It goes back and forth.
Well,
it's a love thing and a honoring and living out the righteousness. And in that, we can be justified.
Yeah,
because there's no wrong.
Because that's why I always like the using the word trust for faith. You know, it's obviously there's different shades of meaning there, but trust is, I think, a much easier word, because people have over-theologized the idea of faith. But faith is trust. I mean, if you have faith in someone that they're going to do something that they say, you can trust that that will happen. You've got to have trust.
Well, David Stone calls it, and I really agree with him, trusting faithfulness.
Oh, yeah.
So it is it's a two-way street. You're
good.
Putting your trust in God, but you're also being faithful.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
But I'm seeing something, at least for me, that is deeper also. We're all told that Torah is teaching.
Mm-hmm.
With what Paul has said, with what we're learning, our keeping the Torah, my decision to keep the Torah, is going to be a reminder to me of how unrighteous my flesh is and how unable I am to even keep the Torah. That's going to make me recognize daily how dependent I am on the blood of Messiah.
Amen.
Yeah. Yeshua.
Good.
And it shows, it just is a constant reminder of his sacrifice for us, which should keep me in a place of humility before him, seeing my dependence, so I'm going to fear him in the way he wants me to fear him, so that faith is perfected in that. It's trusting him.
Yeah, and you know what? That is what Satan fears the most, because if you look at Revelation, at the end of Revelation chapter 12, the dragon was enraged over the woman and went away to make war with the rest of her seed, those keeping the commandments of God and having the testimony of Yeshua the Messiah. So it's, that makes it very powerful. It's a very keeping, isn't it?
Yes.
Why is he so mad at the ones who believe in Yeshua and keep the commandments? It's because we are the people of God, as much as observant. Yes. Yeah.
Good. Maybe I missed it too, but you didn't answer Kathy's question.
Okay. Getting there. Just want to just clarify this about Ergon Namu. Okay. Works of law. This has a rough kind of equivalent in Hebrew of, you know, Ma'aseh HaTorah, which means works of the Torah or works of the law. Now, those comments, you know, works of law, ergo namu, and also Ma'aseh HaTorah in Hebrew, you know, you don't find Ma'aseh HaTorah in the Tanakh or in the, you know, the Hebrew scriptures. But where you do find it is in the Dead Sea Scrolls, in their, I guess you'd call it their sectarian guidelines for their community. And in that case, it means basically the rulings of a particular community on what to follow. In other words, we would call it in Hebrew, it's known as halakha, or judgments that a community makes. Now, the way that the Dead Sea Scrolls use that is that these are things that God prescribes, such as keeping the Shabbat, circumcision, you know, the Levitical dietary laws in chapter 11. These are things that God says. However, the way that they're used as halakha is that they are a deciding factor. You call them, they're often described as boundary markers. This is Jew who does these things. This is non-Jew who doesn't do those things. They're basically the outward signs that someone is a Jew or not a Jew. Now, where does this bear into the discussion of works of law, meaning just observing the law, as the NIV puts it, versus works of law as observing things as a boundary marker? You're a Jew, or I'm a Jew, you're a Gentile, and look at the difference. If you take a time to look at where you'll see ergo namu show up a lot, works of law, or however your translation puts it, is in Galatians chapter 2. I invite you to take a look at that and look at what the context of that passage is. That is Peter. You might remember this thing that Paul and Peter got into a little tiff over, and that was the idea that when the, as they say it, the folks of the circumcision would show up, Peter would distance himself after he had been eating and communing with the other Gentile believers and such. When these guys would show up, he would kind of separate himself off. And Paul called them on the carpet for that. And basically saying this, you know, you're trying to make a distinction between us and them over works of law. But they're justified by God through faith. They're part of the community here, you know. The righteousness is something that God works on with people on his own timing. And we see that with Acts chapter 15, where the ruling of the council in Jerusalem says, look, there's just a few things to keep the community in order, and these basic few things that new believers should adhere to. Okay, circumcision is not one of them. So once you get these in place, Sabbath after Sabbath, they're going to hear God's word read, and the rest will come in on the Holy Spirit's own timing.
Well, wasn't that just because circumcision is simply a commandment in Torah for those of descendant of Abraham? If you're a descendant of Abraham, circumcision applies to you, because that's part of God's covenant with Abraham, is it not?
Well, what is it then that Messiah, John the Baptist, even Paul himself said about descendants of Abraham?
Circumcised the heart before they were circumcised in the flesh.
Bingo. It was by faith that folks became descendants of Abraham. You know, it's kind of the great description. Look, I can even make rocks into descendants of Abraham. You know, I can make descendants of Abraham all around. Okay. So I guess it's time to come to an end on this, but I want to at least get to Kathy's thing before we close here. One of the things that Yeshua brought up in talking about children of Abraham and is a very interesting thing. He says that children of Abraham, or kind of generally talking about believers, need to have righteousness that surpasses righteousness. Or as, you know, you have one translation here, Matthew chapter 5, righteousness that surpasses the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. Now look at the whole passage here and what you're talking about. This is Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 17. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill them. For surely I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commands and teaches others to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. So what then follows in the whole rest of the Sermon on the Mount, as it's called, Matthew chapter 5 through 7? Character of God expressed specifically how? How is God's character expressed? Okay.
The fruit of their life.
He always says these little phrases. You have heard it said, but I tell you. You have heard it said, but I tell you. You have heard it said, but I tell you. What is all that referring to?
Well, the leaven of the Pharisees, the mixture, the twisting of the word instead of walking.
The spirit of the law.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what you're talking about, Hank, is he mentioned here the spirit of the law. You know, if your righteousness stops at the letter on the page only and not seeks to get to the heart of God on each of these things that goes forward,
then it doesn't supersede that of the Pharisees.
No. Because that was one of the big issues that Yeshua had, was he always talks about hypocrites and hypocrisy. Well, what is hypocrisy?
Saying one thing and doing another.
You just go by what is written, but your actions may do something completely different. Or in the case of some of the teachings, actually having a separation there between Jew and Gentile. So that is one of the things that we'll wrap up with, I guess, tomorrow on the first day of Unleavened Bread. What do you think the topic of discussion will be?
Unleavened bread.
Unleavened bread, yeah. All right, very good. Yeah, star student, yeah.
Why did he say renewed, or why did he say new commandment when it's already in the Old Testament?
Well, he also said, here I tell you a new command, love one another.
Mm-hmm. So why did he say new? Because New Testament believers who don't believe in the Old Testament anymore think that that's the new commandment that we're supposed to follow and not the Torah.
But the thing, though, is that when you look at Matthew chapter 5 through 7, are you seeing anything new?
No.
Or are you hitting, seeing the reset button?
Why did he say the new concept?
Well, you know, for example, here's one of the things, just a concrete example. Yeshua talks about, he says, about divorce. And Moses allowed you to have divorce his wife, right? But I say to you, right, you have heard it said, but I say to you, anybody who even looks on a woman is guilty of committing adultery, and there is no room. It's a much stricter interpretation of the Torah than the Pharisees had, actually. So in other words, that in that sense, it's a newer command, I think. In other words, he's not breaking, he's actually pushing the Torah further. Moses allowed divorce. Jesus says no divorce. In that sense, it's new.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And because he also says, he kind of gives it a little parable, you know, it's like someone who's bringing out new treasures as well as old. The treasures have always been there, but it depends on who's teaching you. You know, depends on who's teaching. So let's close with prayer.
It's a much stricter interpretation of Torah than the Pharisees ever had. Yeah.
Father God, we thank you and praise you for taking time to be with us, and we ask for your blessing upon your word. May it not go out unfruitful. We ask for wisdom. We ask for understanding. We ask for patience. And Father, we just ask for you to change us in your timing, and that we follow your timing and we follow your lead wherever you go. And we thank you for all these things. In the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.